On today's episode, we dive into the somewhat murky world of annuities. What are they? And when should you consider them? If ever, we're tackling a listener question from Gene. And to help us with this question, Big Earn from Early Retirement Now is joining us on the show. Welcome to the ultimate crowdsourced personal finance show. This is your Friday Roundup.
You're listening to Choose FI Radio. The blueprint for financial independence lives here. If you're looking to unlock the secrets to financial independence and early retirement, you're in the right place. Stay tuned and join a community of like-minded people who are getting off the hamster wheel and taking control of their lives in the pursuit of financial independence. Choose FI, your home for financial independence online.
All right, guys, super excited to tackle a listener question from Jean talking about her particular situation with annuities. We have Big Earn joining us later on the show to help us with that question. But to help me now, I have my co-host Brad here with me today. How you doing, buddy?
Hey, Jonathan, I am doing quite well. Yeah, what's going on in your world?
Well, the biggest thing is I completed two pretty significant DIY projects, more or less assisted, depending on which one we're talking about. I rebuilt the fence in our front yard. We had actually extended the backyard a little bit and we tackled this project. My takeaway from building a fence was one, wear sunscreen. And two, never do that again.
Oh man. How many hours of labor did it take?
About 20 hours combined into 2 days. Our friend Ed, he actually was in town, and when he saw me, his words were, "Wow, man, you're looking kind of haggard." Exact quote, not exactly a compliment.
Oh man, somewhat like a haggard lobster, I guess.
That's exactly it. The other one was I tackled a tile job. Now, I didn't get a chance to do quite as much of this as I wanted to, just because a buddy of mine was helping me with it, and he brought an additional friend to help him with like some small amount of plumbing work. So I kind of was that odd man, third man out, kind of looking over their shoulders, but I got enough time in to get a basic understanding of how to do it. And, you know, as I was kind of assisting where I could with this project, at the end of it, I was like, this is amazing. You know, and I suspect this is one of those things that, like, if it's a small little bathroom, awesome. If you're trying to retile your entire kitchen, it's probably going to feel more like the fence job. But it was very satisfying. And dude, I have a picture. I posted it in our Choose FI DIY group of the before and after on the tile work. I mean, it was probably only about 6 to 7 hours of total labor, and it totally transformed the bathroom.
Yeah, it went from looking like a 1970s or early 80s bathroom to a brand new updated bathroom. It was pretty amazing.
Unbelievable, dude. And like, honestly, if you have the skill set, which honestly, you could get the skill set with about maybe an hour of watching tutorials on YouTube, and then the supplies, which I told you a couple weeks ago, only came to about $100. Think about like the difference for that bathroom with just 7 hours of labor, $100 of supplies, and a little bit of time on YouTube. Done.
Yeah. So Jonathan, just going back to the fence for a sec. So you basically, this one you did yourself. You spent about 20 hours. And I know I saw the pictures. It looks gorgeous. How much did you save just on the fence alone?
So there's kind of two parts to this. You have your supplies. So for that fence, and it was a pretty large stretch of area, my outlay was about $548. Just about, you know, I'm just trying to be approximate here. $548.35. Not that I'm counting. No. But then the other half of that is the labor. So I paid my friend for his time that he spent working with me on that project. But I estimate by me being that other hand, by me putting the other half in over what I would have paid if I just went out and got a team to do it, I'm sure that I saved well over $1,200.
Wow. That's not nothing. It looks brand new, like a professional did it. So, and you learned real world skills, which is important. I mean, I don't suspect you're going to do this ever again, but if you had to, you definitely could, right?
Yeah, it's an Einstein quote. Well, I know 1,000 things that won't work, or at least one thing that I won't try again.
Yeah, that's very cool, Jonathan. And yeah, just kind of talking about saving money. I actually have this little second generation FI story with my kids and my wife. I mean, I think a lot of people often ask us, how do we try to educate our kids about finance? And are we overtly sitting them down and teaching them lessons, or just basically how does it work? And I mean, I think this is really going on, at least in our household, just kind of in the background. As lessons come up, we show them through our own actions, but then often we'll sit down and really talk them through it. So this was a perfect example, I think. Laura was helping out at the school with the Teacher Appreciation Week. Okay. So she had to get, I think, like 24 sheets of yellow cardstock. If she just wanted to take the mindless way out here, she would have walked into the store and said, "Hey, I'd like 24 pieces of yellow cardstock. That's 59 cents each." And it would have cost about $14. She actually took the girls and talked them through what her alternate method was to save money and to actually walk out of there with more cardstock for the future. So what she did was she noticed that they had 50 packs of various colors, 10 sheets of each color. So there were five different colors, and it was only $3 for this 50 pack. You see where this is going, right? She wound up buying three of these 50 packs for $9. She got her 24 yellow that she needed, obviously, plus six left over. And actually, there were 126 sheets left over, right? Because she bought three 50 packs for $9, only needed 24 of them. She has 126 sheets left over, and she saved $5. It's just one of these little things, but the little things really are the big things in life. And my kids saw their mom think through a problem of, okay, this is the easy way. Maybe there's a better method. After it was all done and we got home, Laura really sat them down and talked them through what exactly she did, how much money she saved, and that now they have 126 sheets to play with. I mean, that's just a cool little story. And I think I would challenge the audience, find those little lessons in life that you can pass on to your kids. These little things, they go a long way.
That's awesome, man. I mean, it sounds to me like one of the lessons that your kids are learning is kind of price per unit, right? And that's something that you could gloss over, but there's other ways that you could accomplish that. You could start having them think that way. I think that many people, like going back to kind of the grocery store example that we've used several times, many people are just oblivious to even the concept of price per unit and then how to compare apples to apples. And that actually in and of itself is a very useful skill set for your kids. So one way to cultivate that could be to like just take them to an aisle of like their favorite types of food and then have them just compare which one of these is actually the better deal and get away from looking at necessarily total cost, but price per unit. I wonder if there's like multiple ways that you could actually accomplish kind of that baseline understanding of looking at dissimilar objects and then finding the common ground.
Yeah, that's interesting. I mean, I guess you could maybe make a game of it. Go to a couple different stores and price match. What does this cost at Wegmans versus Walmart versus Publix? To see, hey, this is the same item and it costs dramatically different prices across these three different stores. So yeah, I mean, I think there's lots of lessons if you're looking for them. Sometimes the lessons come to you. We actually had another one where the girls actually, I think it was Anna, asked us, why do they ask when you check out debit versus credit? She'd never heard us mention a debit card before. Obviously, we've talked about credit cards, right? I mean, we're constantly telling them how we earn these travel rewards points, and they get that conceptually, but I guess they don't really know. I mean, they're little kids. They have no sense of what a debit card is versus a credit card. So it morphed into this really long conversation of technically, like, what occurs? You know, because we pay on time and in full every month with our credit cards, we're basically getting like an interest-free loan as opposed to a debit card. The money comes out of the bank instantly. And when we mentioned interest on a credit card, Molly, my little one, said, "What is interest?" So then it goes into a learning lesson about how to earn interest on the good side and what happens when you have to pay interest. So, I mean, Jonathan, this one query of why do they ask debit versus credit was like this 15 plus minute engaging conversation with the four of us. And I think our kids left smarter for it. You know, I mean, they learned something. It wasn't boring. It wasn't us lecturing to them about, oh, don't get into credit card debt. I mean, it was none of this. It was genuine curiosity that just kept going and going. It was a really fun experience.
That's awesome, man. Yeah, it's great when you can start putting together enough of these ideas to really start almost building a roadmap for your child's FI education. Why didn't I learn this sooner? Why didn't I find out about this sooner? Well, we can rectify that for the next generation for sure.
Yeah, you're right. I mean, we certainly can rectify it. And I think that's a lot of what we talk about here at Choose a FI, right? Is bringing these lessons to your family. How do you make this set in? You make it part of your life, but you don't make it overbearing. I think that's my high level, how to pass this on in a second generation FI manner is just look for these learning opportunities and really embrace them and talk about it. And don't just say, oh, debit versus credit, you don't need to know that. How many parents would just not even listen? We did. And it turned into this fun experience. And I really challenge you out there, try to find these little learning lessons and go for it.
And Brad, you kind of mentioned this in passing, kind of the difference between debit and credit. You know, it reminded me, like, one of our most downloaded episodes of all time is our travel rewards episode, episode 9 of our podcast, where we kind of walk through a very simple strategy to travel the world for less using travel rewards and credit card signup bonuses. I went back and listened to that episode very recently, and it has aged very well. It's incredibly relevant information. It's a wonderful place to start, but we got 5 emails this week asking a very similar question. Hey guys, I know you recorded this episode a couple years ago. I'm looking to get started with my travel rewards journey. Is the Chase Sapphire Preferred still the place to start?
Yeah, Jonathan, that is a great question. I believe that it still is the place to start. To me, the Sapphire Preferred is the number one credit card to start with. So we're recording this on May 7th, 2019, and the bonus was actually recently increased to 60,000 points sign-up bonus after you spend $4,000 in the first 3 months. And there is a $95 annual fee on this card. That's really a phenomenal bonus. I know it was 50,000 points for a very long time. These points, so they're called Chase Ultimate Rewards Points. I believe, at least for the way that I use travel rewards points, these are the most flexible and valuable points that exist. So basically, you have 3 different options when it comes to redeeming these Ultimate Rewards points that you get with the Sapphire Preferred. The first is the least valuable. Basically, it's just like 1 cent per point. So those 60,000 signup points would be worth $600, which is not bad, obviously, but that's just for straight cash.
So can I just clarify, basically, you said a $95 annual fee. So your worst case scenario is that you pay $95 and you get a $600 reward bonus.
Yes, correct. Right. So you're netting $505 to the good at the very worst. And that's the worst possible way. And I say that kind of jokingly, the worst way to redeem this. So if that's your worst option, then you're in pretty good shape. The way that this works is basically as you get more potential value, there's slightly less flexibility. So obviously the most flexible thing possible is cash. That 1 cent per point is your lowest redemption rate. Then with the Sapphire Preferred, the next possible option is you get 1.25 cents per point. In this case, this would be $750 worth of value if you book travel through the Chase Ultimate Rewards portal. That means you just go to their search engine and it operates like Travelocity or Kayak or something, right? You just put your travel in. Where am I going? And it shows up, the flights, the hotels, et cetera. You can use your points to book and you can even use partial points. So even if you don't have enough, it's not like you're shut out of it. You're just using those points at a value of 1.25 cents per point. That's $750, like you said, net the 95 fee, but you're still $650 plus to the good. The third option is the most potentially valuable, but it's also the one with possibly, I guess you would argue, the least flexibility because you're actually using these as true travel rewards points and miles because they have 13 airline and hotel transfer partners. So when these points sit in your Chase account, they actually reside in your Chase account. But if you decide you want to transfer them to one of the partners, then they become those miles or points in that particular program. And I love many of their partners, most specifically Southwest, Hyatt, United, and British Airways, I guess would probably be my fourth. But let's just say Hyatt is a perfect example. You've got 60,000 points from this signup bonus. I know I've got a Hyatt right down the road from me that my parents sometimes stay at when they come to visit. It's only 5,000 points per night. So, I mean, you could get 12 free nights at that hotel for just this one credit card signup bonus. And that's amazing. Or, for instance, the hotel that we went to for spring break down in Florida, it was like a $500 a night hotel. And at that time, it was only 15,000 points per night. So that would be 4 free nights. I mean, that would be a $2,000 trip for free just using this one credit card signup bonus. So you see where there's potentially much more value transferring them. Again, I love United, Southwest, and Hyatt specifically.
Yes, that Sapphire Preferred has been a longstanding partner in my wallet. It's a fantastic card. And to our audience listening to this, we have partnered with Card Ratings for our coverage of credit cards. They are an affiliate of this program. If you want to get started with your travel rewards journey and simultaneously you want to support the show, easiest way you can do that is just go to choosefi.com/CSP. C is in Chase, S is in Sapphire, P is in Preferred. choosefi.com/CSP to start your travel rewards journey today. Well, normally, Brad, I would spend a lot of time actually diving into this episode with Mark, but I feel like between the episode that we did with him, how thorough he was with the information, and then when you pair that with the awesome episode that we did with Chelsea Brennan talking about the emergency binder, both of those together, I think, are a really great thematic package for people that are thinking about estate planning and what do you do before you even get to that point that you are estate planning. So Chelsea, with kind of thinking about what do I need long before I ever get to that end of life type scenario, this all-encompassing document, and then Mark coming in with this very thorough deep dive into both wills versus trust and how those fit into what we kind of umbrella term as a solid estate plan. I was really excited with what he actually shared with us and with our community. I think one of the lingering questions is how to find a good attorney to help you with this process if you're wanting to go that route, and then also how to if you are going to use some sort of form, how to navigate good ones versus bad ones, and then how to be aware of what maybe those documents aren't answering.
Yeah. And I think just like anything in life, a lot of it is going to come down to recommendations from friends, colleagues, family. That's where I would start in my local area. I'd start in the Choosify local group for Richmond and ask about attorneys. So I think that's a good starting point. And yeah, I agree with you. These two episodes back to back, it was just really helpful. I know for me personally, and I have to assume for the audience as well, and there's just a ton of information and it's really, really important. And even though you and I each personally just went through an estate planning session, I know I learned new things from Mark that I need to get these documents in place. The pre-need guardian, that was something that just did not cross my mind or cross my plate. And he's saying basically, if you're incapacitated, but you have not passed away, this legally gives someone the ability to make decisions for your kids. And I mean, that's crucially important. Even something like this temporary guardianship, if the person you appointed lives far away, someone needs to guard these children for even just X number of hours for my family to drive here from New York. Something like that you don't think about, but it's really important. So anyway, I would highly, highly suggest that if this is something that's important to you, if you have family, if you have people who rely on you, go back and listen to those two episodes and just make moves, take action, right? That's what we always say here at Choosify. You need to take action. And this is really crucially important.
So are you going to be updating your brandly new updated will? Is that on your to-doist, Brad?
Yeah, you know, it is. I mean, I don't think I need to. I think it's just an additional document. So yeah, I'm going to certainly get in touch with my estate lawyer and ask. I mean, who knows? Maybe it's buried in there in some of the documents, but the way that Mark described it, it is a distinct document. So I don't suspect it's going to be that difficult, but it's important, right?
I agree, man. It's going on my list as well. All right, so big announcements regarding the Playing with Fire documentary. I think our audience has been waiting for this, well, frankly, for close to 2 years. And we teased a couple weeks ago that it is coming to a theater near you in mid-June. And we have some updates on that. Great news. Now, first, Brad, let me go ahead and send this over to you. But my understanding is there are 7 cities that already have a screening locked down for the very beginning of June. Can you give us a little bit more details on what cities those are?
All right, Jonathan. So yeah, there are 7 cities where Scott and his team are organizing larger screenings, let's say. So they are taking the reins on this one. And it's San Diego, San Francisco, Seattle, Detroit, Washington, D.C., New York City, and Atlanta.
And I know we're hoping to be at a couple of those. I know for sure we will be at the San Diego event on June 1st and hopefully at a couple of the others as well.
Yeah. And Jonathan, the event in San Diego is locked down for June 1st. And we will have, if you're in that area, we'll have the link to buy tickets in our show notes. I know Scott is setting up a page, I believe at playingwithfire.co/events. But yeah, we'll definitely have the specific links for each of those 7 cities in our show notes as they become available.
And to access the show notes, the easiest way to do that is just go to choosefi.com/126R, choosefi.com/126R. Now, screenings to all other cities across the country become available starting, I believe, right around June 15th. if you want to be a part of that, this is something that would be a wonderful event for a local group. If you're not already in a local group, you can just go to chooseify.com/local. The admins for the local groups will have the link and will be setting up screenings in your particular city. Just make sure you're part of the local group. Look for the thread on Friday. If you don't see one, just ask, hey, has anybody set it up yet? But I mean, with hundreds of local groups in every major city around the country, this is something that can easily happen in your area. There needs to be a minimum of 70 tickets sold in order to lock down and make the screening official. It could be a wonderful event. If you want to bring a friend and introduce a friend to the concept of financial independence, I think it's going to be a fantastic time. I know many of the local groups are planning on doing some sort of meetup or meeting for drinks or food after or before the movie. So it could be a really awesome event, really awesome day, and definitely would love for you to be a part of it. So anyways, all that being said, make sure that you're a part of a local group. Just go to chooseify.com/local, find a group in your area. And if you don't already see the thread on Friday for someone sharing the link to where you can get a ticket for the official screening for your area, just ask them, hey, what's up? We'll be making sure we share all the information with the admins for each local group so that that will be possible. All right, Brad, well, let's go ahead and transition. What I want to do next is bring on a listener question that we got from Gene asking a very targeted question about annuities. And I realize that to this point, we really have not gone in depth talking about annuities, and mostly that is due to my woeful lack of knowledge, and yours is only marginally better. So we're leaning on our in-house experts, and Big Earn is going to help us today. He's done a fairly significant amount of research into the various products that are out there categorized under this umbrella banner of annuities. There are many different types, and I thought we could do the whole gamut. We could do a definition of terms. We could kind of parse the differences between the different variations, and specifically, we could use all that information to help Jean with her question. So, Karsten, are you ready for this?
Sure. All set.
Hello, Choose FI, Jonathan and Brad. My name is Jean, and I've just recently found Choose FI, and I'm really grateful I found you guys. I've actually been looking for you all my life. I just finished listening to J.L. Collins's series on stocks and investments, and particularly podcast number 36, and listened very closely to his comments on annuities. Well, I am just sick to my stomach because I had a financial advisor sell me an annuity last year for $150,000, which was actually more than half of my assets. I'm 61 years old, and I have been seeking answers to the best way to invest to secure a retirement. And I can't tell you how many people I asked and how many other advisors I asked about whether or not an annuity was a good option for me. And what I kept being told by the advisor who sold it to me was that it would provide a long-term pension for me. I anticipate living to be in my 90s just because I'm basically healthy and my parents and grandparents have lived long lives. So I thought this was a good option for me. So my question for you all, so that I can sleep better at night, what can I ask my advisor, who, by the way, is no longer managing my equities because I realized that, you know, he was getting everything he was getting out of me from the annuity. I wasn't going to let him continue to siphon off money from my equities account. But my question is, to you all, is how can I reconcile this choice that I made of purchasing an annuity? I guess my biggest fear is that when I'm 85, this company will go bankrupt. Anyway, any thoughts on this are appreciated. Thank you for all the work you're doing, and I look forward to more podcasts from you all.
So, Gene, thank you so much for the question. I think you're providing us a wonderful opportunity to go into some depth and talking, you know, definition of terms. What is an annuity? And then more, probably more relevant to your situation, twofold, you know, when is a good time to use it? Is there ever a good time to have an annuity? And then also, if you decide that you're in one or you ended up in one by accident, are there any advantages in unwinding it in any particular fashion? Or is it just kind of, all right, we're in it. It'll just, you know, we'll just have to stick ride it out at this point. All amazing questions and ones that I am woefully unprepared by myself to answer. And Brad is only moderately better at. So Big Earn, welcome to the show, man. We're throwing you on the hot seat and we cannot wait for your input. I guess to start, a little definition of terms here. When people start talking about annuities, what is this magical vehicle that they are describing?
Yeah, so an annuity basically means there are many different types of annuities, but there are two different types that would probably be applicable here. So one is an immediate annuity. You hand over a certain chunk of money to an insurance company, and then that company is going to pay you a monthly, quote unquote, salary until you pass away. And then you can structure it many different ways. So it could be on your own single life annuity. It could also be a joint annuity. So you could do this as a couple, and you could designate the couple to be the beneficiaries. And then the annuity pays until the last survivor dies. It could also be the many different parameters to pick. Usually you could also have annuities where if both spouses are, if the main spouse is still alive, you get a certain amount. And then if that spouse died and the other one is still alive, then you get, say, 75% of the benefit until the last survivor passes away. So that would be an immediate annuity. And then there's also something called a deferred annuity where, again, you hand over the money immediately, but the payments don't start until a little bit later. So this is apparently what Jean did with her advisor. And of course, the disadvantages for the deferred annuity is that the payments start later. But then, of course, that's offset because this is all done in an actuarially fair way that, yeah, if your payments start later, then the payments will also be larger because they start further in the future. So this deferred annuity is apparently what she got, and it sounds like it's an annuity that has a fixed monthly payment, because there are also some other ways of doing annuities that's usually marketed to younger investors who have already maxed out all of their tax advantage accounts, and they're called variable annuities and indexed annuities. But that's apparently not what she did. So because the advisor said, well, you don't have a pension and I'm going to set up something. So that's why it sounds like this is this fixed level payment until she dies to essentially model your own personal pension. That's the way this annuity was structured.
Just to be clear here, Carson, so she handed over, let's say, $150,000 and bought this annuity contract. Right. And it is good until either she passes away or whoever surviving spouse may be, et cetera. But, you know, that's kind of diving into the details. But the most important point is that $150,000 is gone, right? That's not coming back, the actual principal, right? It's just, in most cases, it's just this pseudo pension that she's earned, right? Right. That's what she's getting, correct?
Again, it doesn't hurt to check with the insurance company that manages this annuity if there's any way you can get out of it. But as a 99.99% chance that this is now gone. And of course, the money is not gone. She is still entitled to that annuity. Because if there was any kind of an optionality, the people would use this and abuse it, and you would have the adverse selection. And can you imagine, right? As Uncle Jimmy's on his deathbed, and you tell the doctors, no, you have to keep him on life support a little bit longer because we're trying to get out of the annuity contract, right? So, and just exactly because of that reason, it will be either impossible or extremely difficult or extremely disadvantageous to get out of the annuity now. And that says this is probably water under the bridge, and she wouldn't be able to get out of this. And now she has to decide what she does conditional on being stuck with this annuity. And so that's obviously what we want to talk about. But we could also talk about a little bit about, well, what advice should we give in her if she had talked to us first before going to her advisor? So
let me ask you that question. All right. So let's say that someone has been primed to consider an annuity. And so they come to this show ahead of time and they say, all options being equal, age, demographics, wealth, all being where they are at now, should I be going all in? You know, should I get this annuity? I've been pitched on it as being a wonderful vehicle for fixed income, providing me, you know, basically security. So it smooths the ride because everybody should have some level of fixed income. What are your thoughts in terms of, you know, where annuities fit into the financial picture? And I guess as you tie this to something like sequence of return risk, right?
Right. So I usually advise against going with an annuity, but there's one advantage of an annuity that I have to concede, that there's something to it. And I'm just going to point it out. I don't think that there's such a great advantage, but I'll just point it out. And the advantage is that this is a safe and efficient and also simple way of turning one big chunk of money into a stable cash flow. We all know that it's very simple to turn cash flow into a big net worth, right? Jim Collins, Mr. Money Mustache. Going the opposite route is not so easy, right? That's why I wrote 30 plus parts on safe withdrawal rates.
And you're not it's done. Actually come,
and I'm not done. I'm not even halfway done. So, and it's not simple. And you have sequence of return risk. You're exposing yourself to the uncertainties of asset markets. So I can see that people are interested in annuities because this is the way of turning one big chunk of money into a stable cash flow. Especially because people could say that, well, you could simulate your own annuity. You just take a fixed income portfolio because that's what the insurance company would do. They just invest that money in bonds and then pay out the principal and interest over time. The one thing that the insurance company can do that we cannot do as individuals is to hedge this longevity risk, right? So, because for example, I could build some kind of a bond ladder or a CD ladder. I guess CD ladder might be a little bit too, I don't think they have CDs going out to 30, 40, 50 years maturity, but say if you have a 30 year retirement horizon, then you could build what's called a bond ladder, right? You could buy bonds that mature in the future at 30 years, at 29 years, at 28 years, and you buy just enough of these bonds over time that they exactly expire over your retirement horizon. And then the principal plus interest over time hopefully generates a more or less stable income over time. The problem with that is you have to decide what exactly is that horizon, right? So if you build a bond ladder or a CD ladder, what do you do if you outlive that last payment? Your income is gone. Right. Whereas with the annuity, you are guaranteed to get this income for as long as you live. And so you would benefit from the annuity if you live longer than that last bond in your bond ladder or that last CD in your CD ladder. And you would obviously lose money if you die before, because then the money is gone and you could have given that money as an estate to your kids or to a charity. So in that sense, there is this advantage of an annuity that it hedges your longevity risk. So I'm just going to point that out. So that is the one advantage of an annuity and the one selling point of an annuity. Of course, the big disadvantages are the high fees and then also the illiquidity. But so again, just for the record, I wanted to point out that there is, at least in theory, one reason to at least consider an annuity. And I usually advise against it, and we can get into the reasons just in a few minutes.
All right. So I just wanted to preface the thing about an annuity in particular, that if we were going to try to come up with an alternative, it would hopefully provide some of the benefits of the annuity minus some of the cons. But let's say you have a portfolio of several hundred thousand dollars and you give this to the insurance company in exchange for this fixed income, either now or down the road. When you pass, that money that you gave to the insurance company is gone. That's the big thing. So you pay a fee to give it to them. So it costs you some points on the front side. And then at the end of this runway, you've gotten this benefit, this fixed income over a period of 5, 10, 15, 20, maybe 100 years, right? whatever duration right. you're alive yeah. for. But then at the end of that perpetual money-making machine is no longer yours. It is the insurance company to take into the future, right? That's the trade-off.
Right. So it is basically your own personal pension. And there are some annuities that have a certain minimum number of years that they pay. I mean, there's so many different bells and whistles you can put in, and each insurance company, they have their own idiosyncratic little riders and options that they have. And then, of course, if you want a minimum number of years, that will also lower your income. There are also some other options like cost of living adjustments, right? So there are also annuities that raise the income by a certain percentage every year, say 2%. But then again, you will start then with the lower income in the beginning, and then it goes up by 2% every year. And so everything is done in an actuarial fair manner. Because obviously the insurance company has to manage this and doesn't want to lose money on this.
So Carson, I want to ask about safe withdrawal rates and how this might tie in. So as I understand it, you kind of say a safe withdrawal rate, so not including annuities, right? We're just talking about mm-hmm. equities, somewhere between, let's say, 3.25% and 4%, maybe just back of the envelope. So let's just say, for argument's sake, you had $1 million. You could take out somewhere between 30 and 40,000 or 32 and 40,000. Again, back of the envelope, nobody's holding holding you to these numbers.
Right.
But at least as I understand your calculations, that's to preserve the ultimate capital, right? That's not to exhaust it. Correct?
No. So the 4% rule is also, in the worst possible case, you exhaust the money after 30 years. That's actually one of the reasons why I believe we shouldn't use the Trinity study results and expand them from 30 years to 60 years or the 40, 50, 60 years. Because in the worst possible case, the 4% rule would also exhaust the money after 30 years. Of course, in the best possible case, you have tons of money left over after 30 years. This is the problem. You have the uncertainty of asset market returns over time.
But I mean, Carson, just sticking the money under your mattress, you would have 25 years worth of it, right? So,
right.
As I've seen, and obviously you're the expert, so I defer to you, but you know, as I've seen a lot of people calculate it, it's based significantly on the preservation of that capital to some degree. Whereas with an annuity, it is gone from day one. Obviously, I know you're disagreeing, and again, I defer to you. But like, do you see
sounds like a deferral, total deferral.
So no, first of all, sticking under the mattress, you don't have 25 years because under the mattress, you get no inflation adjustment. The 4% rule assumes that you adjust your withdrawals by inflation. So it's already a little bit less than 25%. Then if you start right around the peak of the stock market, you have sequence of returners. So you withdraw your money at depressed equity prices. So that's how, even with equity market returns, and even with equity market returns where they may be in the long term at 6.5% or so, even in real terms, then plus inflation. So even with returns, you could have this unlucky event where you do run out of money after 30 years. So the 4% rule was never designed as a capital preservation vehicle. So if you want to preserve capital over 30 years, you definitely like to withdraw a little bit less than that.
Okay. All right. No, that's very fair. Thank you so much for the clarification. With an annuity, do you have any sense of what percent, in essence, it's paying out?
Yes. We don't know what Gene's annuity is going to pay, but, and of course, it depends on your age, right? So if you are in your early 60s and you want to get an immediate annuity, right, you hand over your money and the payments start in month one, I would look for an annuity income of about 6% annualized. So you hand over $100,000, you stand to receive roughly, give or take a few dollars, of $6,000 a year or $500 a month, and that will last until you die. And this sounds like a lot of money, but remember, this is not inflation adjusted, right? So if you knock off 2% of inflation, this works out to be roughly a 4% withdrawal rate. So this is how annuities, I mean, I could see why people are interested in it. And by the way, this is also never going to be a zero, one, or all or nothing thing, right? I mean, you could always do exactly what Gene did, right? You take part of your net worth, put that in the annuity, keep the other part, and invest that in the stock market, and then have basically your Social Security benefit and your annuity as a consumption floor. You get that every month, no matter what. And then the rest is basically your play money. And then you have a little bit extra flexibility with that. Then I would probably argue at that age, you probably can do 4% or maybe even a little bit more than 4% with the rest of the money. Because if it doesn't work out, you can always cut it a little bit. And well, if you cut your withdrawals from the stock portfolio 15 years into retirement, you're 83 years old at that time, it probably wouldn't hurt you so much. I could see where she's coming from. Again, there are a few points I wanted to get in. I would not have structured this annuity to start at age 73. I would have, first of all, waited, not sign any contract with this annuity and wait until you're 68 and then see how your portfolio looks like. And then if you're still interested in an annuity, I would have bought an immediate annuity at that age, then potentially I would have deferred Social Security until age 70, because Social Security, nice thing is, Social Security is an annuity of sorts too, right? And it's actually a better annuity in the sense that that is CPI adjusted. It's playing around with the start dates. It's also done in an actuarially fair manner, but that's priced, quote unquote, according to the average American. But if Jean, well, first of all, Jean is a woman, so she already has a higher life expectancy. So it would be worthwhile for her to defer Social Security as long as possible. And then if she thinks that she has longevity running in her family, again, there's another reason to delay Social Security as long as possible. So I would have recommended Jean to do the exact opposite. No annuity contract right now. Wait until you're 68. See how your portfolio looks like. Then if you're still interested in an annuity, sign the contract then, and then do the Social Security as late as possible.
If you're older when you sign your annuity, is there also a chance that you're going to get a higher guaranteed return just because they know they're not going to be paying it out, or they suspect they won't be paying it out as long? Is there an aspect of how old or young you are when you start collecting that income will also dictate the percentage return you get?
Yeah. So, I mean, obviously she gets some quote unquote return from waiting between now and 12 years in the future. And that return is comprised of two parts, right? One is the insurance company already has her money. So the insurance company will invest that $150,000, obviously, in a bond portfolio. Then there's also an additional return. It's not really a return, but I mean, there's obviously the possibility that she dies between now and age 73, and then all the money is gone. That death probability is basically rolled into this implicit return, and that would add to the, because it will add to the benefit that she would get at age 73. So I did some back of the envelope calculations, and I also went on the web and just googling,
did some less back of the envelope calculations.
Exactly. And
that's why we love you.
what I found is that she would have roughly doubled her premium if she waits for the 12 years. So she would get somewhere around $1,550 to $1,600 in insurance and in annuity income by committing that $150,000 today. And that sounds like actually pretty decent return, right? Over 12 years, you double your income. Of course, it's not really a doubling, right? Because if you die in between, the money is gone. So this quote-unquote return is rolled into the increase in the annuity income. But she would stand to make a pretty decent annuity income if that annuity that was sold to her gets roughly into the same ballpark. I would suspect it's probably a little bit less because this was sold very aggressively through a financial planner, and he has to make his sales premium, and it might be a little bit less than what you find on the internet if you shop around. Again, everybody who is considering this, buying an annuity, absolutely you want to shop around, right? I mean, people shop around for buying a $500 TV, and you definitely want to shop around before you put $150,000 into an annuity. So, I mean, shop around. And by the way, I think Vanguard, Fidelity, they offer annuities. It's a lot harder to get an explicit quote from them because you have to enter some contact information. I don't want to get any spam phone calls.
And you will get them.
Exactly. I didn't go to Fidelity or Vanguard or any other provider where I had to enter personal information. But yeah, I mean, if you are in the market for an annuity, yeah, I mean, at least get 5 or 6 or even 10 different quotes. It makes sure you go to all of the providers that we love, right? Because they are they're Fidelity and Vanguard. They have low fee index funds. Chances are they will also give you a good deal on an annuity.
Hey, Carson, you just mentioned fees, and I want to kind of dial in on this. And obviously, you can't talk about very specific instances with Jean, et cetera. But do you have any sense of the fees that are usually charged on annuities generally?
Yeah. So I read that the salesperson is going to take anywhere between, say, 2 to 3% and maybe all the way up to 10% of that lump sum as a sales commission. And that is insane. And of course, what you're not going to see that, right? It's not like you're going to get a statement where it says, hey, today's annuity payout is $736. Well, it's actually not $736 because it's only $600 and the $136 goes to fees. So this is one of the other disadvantages of annuities. It's a little bit intransparent, and you don't really see who gets paid along the way, especially because there are a lot of people involved, right? The insurance company wants to make a profit and the salesperson wants to make a profit. There could be many levels of fees. And what I said in the beginning, well, the annuity does something that we can't do as individual investors. It hedges this longevity risk. There is a potential that the fees are actually so high that this advantage of the annuity is also basically arbitraged away and is thrown away, and it lands not in your pockets, but it lands in the pockets of the insurance company and the salesperson.
So I have two thoughts that I wanted to follow up on. One is, in the case of someone listening to this that already has the annuity, so like Jeannie, she already has the annuity. I'm kind of thinking like the mindset for this, it would be valuable. So for instance, we've heard a lot of people put emphasis on getting the fixed income, dividend investors. That was a big focus, not necessarily keeping up with the market, fixed income. We've talked about maybe bond strategies, which we could circle back to, but the annuities, that's the same pitch. You're going to get fixed income. And tying this to the J.L. Collins episode that she referenced, fixed income smooths the ride, right? The stability smooths the ride. The volatility of equities is balanced by your ability to weather the storm. And so, since she already has this, she's pot committed. If she were to build her drawdown strategy around the stability that's already baked in, you could almost make the case that with the remainder of her portfolio, she can afford to be more aggressive. So more equities, more equity exposure, less bond exposure, right?
Yes, 100%. You don't want to make the mistake of now going with the remainder of the portfolio and say, now I do a 60-40, 60% stock, 40% bonds, because she already has 60% of her $250,000 portfolio effectively is in bonds. And so she could even go 100% stocks with the rest of the money. So because you have so much fixed income, and then she also has Social Security, which is also almost like a bond payoff. Yeah, I mean, implicitly, she has a lot of bond exposure in her portfolio. So don't go into bonds too much in the remainder of the $100,000. And by the way, I mean, it sounds like, so she's still working, she's still accumulating assets. So if you now make additional contributions in your 401k plan, she doesn't have a 401k. She could have her own personal 401k plan because she's self-employed, or she has an IRA. I mean, she definitely wants to be very aggressive with her portfolio that she has right now. So don't go, for example, into a target date fund, right? Because the target date fund for her age would now be probably around 50% stocks, 50% bonds. You want to deviate from that advice, given that you already have the fixed income portfolio.
The other question I have for you, someone has come in, they're only listening to this episode because they've been looking for information on what type of annuity to get. That was the only reason they're listening to this episode. And now they're coming out of this wondering, like, what's my big takeaway? I'm going to do an annuity. I want fixed income. You mentioned earlier that there are a ton of different types of annuities and there are all sorts of bells and whistles. And I loved how you mentioned doing some price comparison. You know, spend more time shopping for an annuity than you do for your 4K TV. That makes sense to me.
Right.
But beyond that, when we talk about bells and whistles and we talk about different types of annuities, what are the least offensive, right, of those?
Right.
Which ones should you dial in on, and what features should you look for? And maybe even more importantly, which ones should you avoid?
Yeah. So the easiest to compare is obviously the immediate annuity, right? You tell 5 or 6 or 10 different salespeople, I want to give you $100,000. How much am I going to get as an immediate payout? So no other bells and whistles. At least that's something that you can compare across different companies. That's almost like a commodity, right? This is comparable. There are obviously a few other parameters to consider, right? There's also the credit rating of the insurance company that runs this annuity. So Jeannie, by the way, there's one point I wanted to get in. Jeannie said that she was afraid that the company will go bankrupt. Well, the financial planner might go out of business, but he was just the salesperson, right? The insurance company, I would think that the bankruptcy risk of the annuity itself is relatively low because this is through an insurance company and they're very heavily regulated. And they probably have a lot of excess reserves. So that would be my least concern. But the least offensive type of annuity would be, again, that immediate annuity. So from a sequence of return point of view, you don't want to defer your annuity, right? Because the sequence of return is the worst right around your retirement date. So deferring your annuity does the opposite, right? You have to withdraw more initially, and then later on the annuity kicks in. So it doesn't make any sense to have a deferred annuity. So the only thing that I would even put on the maybe pile would be this immediate annuity. And even that I would consider, if you are so afraid of sequence of return risk, why do you want to tie your annuity to your entire rest of your lifetime and have this illiquid and high cost product? I would just build my own CD ladder for the first 5, 7, or 10 years if I'm really worried about sequence of return risk. So that would put a floor on my expenses, would give me some certainty about my withdrawals over the first, say, 5 or 7 years if I have a certain amount of CDs paying off in the over that first stretch of time in retirement, especially early retirement. If that makes you sleep better, you should probably go with that instead of tying up an entire six-figure sum over your entire rest of your lifetime over many decades. So that's the only annuity I would consider. And even that, I would usually advise against it. Of course, Social Security is definitely the one annuity I like. And then even if you're not interested in annuities, you might be forced to still think about an annuity. For example, some of us still have some pension plans at your workplace, and there you will have the option. Do you take the cash value or do you take the annuity slash pension plan over time? And so whether you like it or not, you will have to make an annuity style comparison calculation. And so when I turn 55, I'll have a small cash value from my former employer that was phased out right after I started working there, but there's still a small cash value. And I will have the option to, do I want to take this as a cash value or do I want to take it as an annuity? And I once did the calculations and I thought the annuity payment wasn't so bad. And I might actually take that annuity, even though otherwise, I would never consider an annuity because of the fees and everything. But if you have it through the workplace, there's a chance that because there are no fees and no salespeople involved, that it's actually a pretty decent deal for you to consider the annuity in that situation.
Yeah, and Carson, that was kind of ties into my final question, which is a lot of people in the FI community are DIYers, right? We want to do it ourselves. And at its essence, this is just math, right? The insurance company is investing it, like you said, in bonds, they're getting some return. Obviously, they're making an income, there's actuarial assumptions. There's also this sales load at the front. So how would you build an annuity? So if this was something you wanted to do, right? You were Gene and you bought into this, you want fixed income, but you have your $150,000 and you want to build it yourself. Is it the CD ladder, as you just mentioned a couple of minutes ago? Like, how would someone do this without all the fees?
Right. So, yeah, I would probably do a CD ladder. And the CD ladder should probably have the length of, say, a business cycle or the average bull market plus bear market. So you smooth out one entire stock market cycle. And then after that, I mean, I would be totally happy with investing all the rest in either 100% equities or close to 100% equities. I would probably go 80-20, somewhere around that. And you do the math, you just for 5 to 7, maybe 8 years, maybe maximum 10 years. You have to designate a certain amount of principal to get, say, to your 3.5 or 4% safe withdrawal. So, I mean, do the back of the envelope calculation, it's probably somewhere around 35 to 40%. By the way, if you do 35 to 40% in a CD ladder and then the rest in equities, boom, you're right back to a 60-40 portfolio roughly. And the only thing that you do differently is that this is essentially a glide path where you start with 60-40. And then you glide to a 100% equity portfolio because you merely withdraw the fixed income portion over the first few years, which is a little bit equivalent to something that I wrote in my series, part 19 and 20, which is about glide paths. And so the glide paths are capable of at least smoothing out a little bit of that sequence of return risk, because you will effectively withdraw from the fixed income portion in case you have a bear market, or you could do it explicitly. You build this CD ladder and then explicitly withdraw only from your fixed income portfolio. And then you just cross your fingers that over the next 10 years, yeah, stocks will do well enough that at that time you have enough money left to run from there.
I don't want to miss this. I personally have a tendency to almost take it for granted, but CD ladder, like mechanically, you have what does that actually look like? So you have $150,000 and you go to your local bank or online or you shop it. Are you putting, if let's say a business cycle is 10 years, you could be using a different number. Let's say you're looking at the first 10 years. Are you dividing your $150,000 that you're starting with by 10 and doing $15,000 each year in a CD? Like, what would be an optimized way to do that? And then again, kind of tied to that same question, as the ladder, as you get to the next rung of the ladder, are you pulling out just the interest on that? Are you pulling out all of it and using it? Are you burning through it? Just kind of mechanically walk us through how a CD ladder functions.
Right. So, I mean, you can do this in a spreadsheet. I think I have some spreadsheet somewhere deep on my hard drive. So it's basically, it may just be as simple as that. If you want to do it in a very imprecise way, you could just do that. You just divide it by 10 and then you buy $15,000 worth of a 10-year CD and $15,000 worth of a 9-year CD all the way down to 1 year, and then you roll with that. You could do it even a little bit more precise than that.
Now that is what we're looking for.
you could say, imagine you want $15,000 after 10 years. Well, you probably buy a little bit less than $15,000 because the $15,000 plus the last year of interest that pays off in that year. So you buy probably something like $14,500 of a CD that expires in 10 years because you know the plus the interest that gives you the $15,000. Now the 9-year CD, you know that obviously after 9 years, you also get a little bit of interest from that 10-year CD, right? So make that $500 income in year nine. So you need to have only $14,500 of additional income from that 9-year CD. And then you don't even have to buy the entire $14,500. Maybe you buy only a $14,100 CD because that CD pays interest after 9 years. And you also get the interest from the 10-year CD. So you basically do this what in math or economics, you would call that by backward induction. So you go from the last year and you see how much you have to buy to satisfy that last cash flow. And then you look at all of the cash flows from the interest that are already guaranteed along the way. And then you check after 9 years, how much do you have to buy? And then you keep going on and on and on, and you get down to maybe 3 years. And you know, for the 3-year CD, you get the interest payment of all the other CDs that expire afterwards. So you may have to buy only, say, I don't know, a $12,000 CD for year three to satisfy your cash flow needs in year three. And then so you roll this down all the way to year one. If you want to go really, really fancy and do this in a mathematically correct way, but as a first approximation, you could just say you chop it up by the number of years and you spread it equally.
No, I'm digging the fancy, man. Can you share that spreadsheet with us so we can include it in the show notes?
Yeah, I have to find that. It might even be a Google sheet.
Yeah.
I'll look that up. Yeah.
Earn, thank you so much for joining us on the show today. This has been educational and also awesome.
Thank you. Thanks for having me. Good luck, everybody.
All right, man. Well, that was an action-packed episode. Huge thanks to Big Earn for joining us on the show today to really dive through that. And I think hopefully Gene got as much value from that episode as I did. Before we wrap up today's episode, I thought we could take a couple minutes just to do some shout-outs for the community. And Zach, what do you got for us today?
All right, Jonathan. So the first one we got is from Larry. His car hits 150,000 miles. And he says, it seems fitting that he was listening to Choose FI when this happened.
Brad, what is your car on, man?
Yeah, I actually just passed a new, every time I get a new 1,000 miles, I'm happy. It was 124,000, which is not bad for an 03 Civic, right?
Nice. I figure by the year 2075, you will hit 200,000.
Sounds about right.
It's the lowest mileage 80-year-old Honda Civic in existence. That's awesome, Larry. Congratulations, man. Look forward to seeing that thing hit 200,000. Well done.
And we got one from Bree. She thanks us for the super detailed show notes.
Yeah. So Bree said, thanks for the show notes on this one. I got lost in all the terms during the episode, but I found it helpful to have the notes break it all down. Thank you. This is a really important topic that we should understand. Totally agree. And also, I almost wish we could have done this retroactively. We didn't really have a system in place for this in the early days. So we were kind of just relying on Brad's
handwritten bullet points. Hey, you should probably know this. But honestly, there's so much more here. And so Sarah has been helping us with the show notes for the last several months. And if you have not yet taken a look at those, they are incredibly detailed. She takes a really remarkable amount of time going through that, tying it to other related resources that you might find useful, making sure that there's background for the information that's being covered. And it really, it's taken the show notes to a whole nother level. So we're really grateful for her joining us on the team to help with that.
All right. And Jonathan, we got one more here. And this is maybe the single most amazing thing I've heard ever related to Chooseify. San Antonio, so our local San Antonio group, is having a going away party for a local group member's kidney. Okay, hear me out here. On May 31st, Shannon, who's actually one of the lead writers at our website at Chooseify.com, she is donating one of her kidneys to a family member of someone in the Chooseify community. What an amazing, amazing demonstration of the power of community and just of human kindness. It blew me away. I mean, this is one of these, you talk about like chills and tears. It's remarkable. So obviously we wanted to mention this on the podcast, and we are having Shannon on the show later this year. We're recording with her, I think, in September. So definitely keep an eye out for that episode later in the year. But that's really, really incredible.
I have chills, man. That's amazing. Shannon, wow. We'll be keeping you in our thoughts, and we can't wait to catch up with you and find out more about your path to financial independence this fall. This is really, really remarkable. All right. Well, unfortunately, that is going to bring this episode to a close. Now, as you know, we like to finish every episode by doing a drawing for a copy of a book that we have found useful. And there's three books that we offer: J.L. Collins' book, The Simple Path to Wealth; Dominic Cortuccio's book, Design Your Future; and the third book from Vincent Puglisi, Freelance to Freedom. If you want to enter the drawing, all you need to do is just go to chooseify.com/iTunes, follow the instructions there, leave us a short written review, and then send us an email to feedback@chooseify.com, letting us know that you left a review and what screen name you left it under. We give away one book for every 5 written reviews that we get, and we announce the winner on the Friday roundup. Brad, how many winners do we have today?
Jonathan, we have one winner today, and the winner is James. And James said, I've binged your podcast for 2 months and listened to 80% of the episodes. I'm a 27-year-old pharmacist, and I've spent the last year and a half trying to find the answer to a Roth IRA question via financial books. No luck. Finally found it with your podcast. Ever since I was 10, I've wondered why people work until they're 60 plus, and I felt like there had to be a better way. I found it with you guys and hope to get integrated into a local group in Knoxville. Currently, my FI plan is to retire at 38, and the confidence is completely due to you all at Choose FI.
And specifically, man, why would you work in a job you hate till you're 70, 75? You now have permission to die. You know, for those individuals that just love their job, amazing, awesome. But I think what this is about is getting that control back. And James, I'm so happy that you found the podcast and you're getting value from it. All right, my friends, the fire is spreading. We'll see you next time as we continue to go down the road must travel.
You've been listening to Choose FI Radio Podcast, where we help middle-class America build wealth one life hack at a time.